right, we're doing a show today about asexuality. Now, most of you who listen to the show know that almost every day we open up with kind of a humorous intro featuring Kyahn Wolf. And we sort of believe that we can do one for many topics that you might not even think that we could do one for. We decided not to do it today. And I think part of it also is as I sort of surveyed what has been done in the past, what has been done in the name of so-called serious journalism, I just realized this is a topic. I mean, I actually watched an interview on The View, God help us, with one of our guests today. And I realized this is sort of, you know, people kind of, there's a little bit of a sense to sort of gravitate almost immediately towards some kind of humorous take on what's actually a pretty serious issue. So we decided not to do it. We could have done it, and it would have been tasteful, and it would have been okay, but we're not doing it. Because there's just, like, I don't know, there's that tendency, and it really kind of bothers me. Anyway, first of all, we're indebted to the guest here in the studio with us, Kathy Way. She's from Middletown, and she wrote to me after one of our recent shows, and she said, you know, I mean, you've never done a show about this, I don't think, but there are some of us, basically, who don't really have, don't consider ourselves, well, here, I've actually even got her letter right here, for most of her life, she hasn't really kind of had sexual feelings towards either sex. And for most of her life, didn't realize that there was kind of any name for that or kind of a way of looking at it. But that there is something called asexuality, and there is an asexual community. And that led us to one of our other guests, David Jay, who's also with us. He's an American asexual activist. Speaking of Middletown, he's a graduate of Wesleyan University, and he's the founder and webmaster of the Asexual Visibility and Education Network, AVEN. Like New Haven without the H. He joins us from the studios of KQED. So, David, I'm going to start out with you. I should also say, as we go along here today, we're going to talk to Tony Bogart. He is a professor of community health sciences and psychology at Brock University, where there's just been a lot of research, actually, about asexuality, some of it done by him, and I think some of it done by maybe grad students of his. I came across some other Brock University stuff in my reading anyway, and later also Julie Decker. She blogs as Swank Ivy. She is an asexuality awareness author and educator. So a lot of people to talk to you today. We'd also love to talk to you if you have a nice question to ask or a comment. 860-275-7266. 860-275-7266. I will now shut up, and David will answer one question, and we'll kind of get the conversation going. But so, David, when we say asexuality, I mean, is there a commonly held definition of what we're talking about, and I guess also what we're not talking about?
Yeah. And first of all, let me say thanks so much for having me on the show. Always a real pleasure. And when we talk about asexuality, an asexual person is someone who doesn't experience sexual attraction. So most people feel a desire to make sexuality a part of how they connect with other people. It may be, you know, when you're walking down the street and you see someone. It may be when you're in a deep, intimate relationship with someone that most people feel a desire to make sex a part of their lives. Asexual people don't have that desire, but we still have the same desire for intimacy, the same desire for emotional connection that everyone else has. So a lot of what the asexual community talks about and focuses on is how do you have that emotional connection without necessarily having sexuality? One other thing you asked, kind of what asexuality isn't, mm-hmm. and one important thing that it's different from is celibacy. Celibacy is a choice. Usually it's people who have an intrinsic desire to be sexual with other people, but just decide that for a period of time they're not going to do that. That's very different than asexual people who don't have that internal desire.
You know, I obviously there probably isn't a one-size-fits-all sort of asexual, you know, that, I mean, I would assume sort of this still kind of comes in stages and gradations. For example, as I was reading more and more about this and wondering more and more about this, since the issue of asexuality is often expressed in terms of attraction or drive or desire, a lack thereof, I began wondering, well, imagine that I were asexual, but in a romantic relationship, which we do know happens, and we'll be talking about that too, and that we wanted to have children. Are some asexuals able to experience somehow arousal and maybe even orgasm, even in the absence of actual sexual attraction to another person?
Yes, and you made a point about sort of gradations. I wanted to build on that quickly and say that it's also, like most things with human sexuality, a spectrum. So there are people at the very bottom of the spectrum, like me, who experience almost no sexual attraction at all. There's also people a little further up the spectrum who identify as gray A, who are sort of in between sexual and asexual. And you're asking about whether there are times that asexual people engage in sexual activity. That's actually another way that we're different from celibacy, is that within the ace community — ace is sort of the slang word for asexual — within the ace community, there it's not too uncommon for people who are in romantic relationships with sexual partners to have reached some kind of compromise and have some sort of sexuality. And that's not sort of seen as a betrayal. It's just a very, very different experience for both partners than it would be if they were both doing something that they were that was kind of they were both intrinsically wired for.
All right. We're talking to David Jay. He is an activist and an organizer for the asexual community. Let me just bring in Kathy Way. She's not an activist. She's not an organizer. But she's the reason we're doing this show, because she wrote to me about this. And Kathy, you sort of described yourself as somebody who kind of fits this definition, but for a long time didn't know there was any kind of word for this, right?
No, I didn't know anything. I just most of the time felt out of place because girls that I went to school with at a certain age went after boys at a certain age. I had absolutely nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And
no interest in girls either.
No interest in girls, no interest in guys. Most of what I was doing all the time was in the woods playing with the guys, but
not that kind of playing.
No.
And at one point, I think you said this to me in your email, at one point, this is maybe 20 years ago, you brought this up with a counselor or a therapist or something like that, and you might have even used a word like asexual. And what did you hear back?
No, there's no such thing.
That everybody is sexual somehow.
Yes.
And this is kind of like an old-time Freudian kind of idea that where everybody's sexual and probably sexuality is this pretty steady drumbeat. It's just that it's either thwarted or diverted or repressed or, you know, and so I'm going to go back to David Jay for a second. Obviously, one of the real big issues here, and we'll be talking about this a little bit more in some of the other segments as we go along here and as we add some of the other guests too. But there are some people listening right now who are thinking what Kathy Way's therapist thought. Well, no, it's, you know, either you have a hormone problem or you're somewhere on the autism spectrum or you have some kind of repressed sexual trauma that is blocking your access to your sexual drives. And David, I'm sure you've heard all those things. And I'm assuming, and based on my reading of your website and a whole bunch of other stuff, I mean, one of the goals here is to have this defined not as a disorder.
Yeah, exactly. And I think I'll start by just saying that, Kathy, I can really relate to what you're talking about. I had the same thing when I was growing up. I remember feeling really isolated. I remember feeling like all my friends and all the adults around me sort of assumed that sexuality was this universal part of being human and was this thing I needed to do to be happy. And that was really isolating, and that was really scary. I didn't know where I fit. And I think, kind of like you were saying, I assumed there was something wrong with me for a long time. And it took me a while to sort of work through that and come to the point where I thought that there wasn't. And part of what helped me to do that was, so I was kind of like you were saying, I was scanning myself. I was saying, there must be some pathology here that's making me unlike what everyone expects me to be. And what I realized was that it was probably far more likely that just as a species, we are diverse, right? As a species, we are diverse in everything else about our sexuality. So why would we not be diverse in the level of sexual intensity that we feel? And the conclusion that I came to about myself, which I think is what we hold in the community, is, look, sex is just one sort of small way of connecting with another person. And so long as I still have ways to connect with other people in the ways that I want to the extent that I want to, in ways that make me happy, in ways that make them happy, then how can you say that anything's wrong with me?
As we go along here, if you have questions, 860-275-7266. Kathy and David both identify as asexuals. We also, you may tweet us at WNPRColin. So what you're saying, David, and I think it's a very eloquent way to put it, too, is if in fact you feel as though you're leading a fulfilled life, basically, without mm-hmm. sexual activity, how can it be a disorder? But there must be some people, maybe in your life, maybe people you bump into when you're doing interviews like this one, people who just can't accept that it must be a disorder. Their idea of sex is such a constant thing that it must be a disorder. What's your answer to that?
I think that my answer to that is to push them on why sex is so important. What is it that sexuality is providing in someone's life that really, you know, that particular, like, abstractly defined set of physical activities, what is that providing in someone's life that they can't get any other way?
That's a good question. And what do people say?
I think that people will sort of struggle to articulate, but I found that when I dive into that question, like, I still have a desire for affectionate physical touch. Mm-hmm. I still have a desire to engage with people in ways that, you know, around things that we're both passionate about. I still, a lot of the things that sex does in terms of helping people connect with their body, in terms of helping them connect with other people, in terms of helping people kind of get to a deep emotional place with someone, that's all stuff I still do. And there's lots and lots of ways to do that. And for me, one of the coolest things about the asexual community is that we really, really explore that. We really explore all of those other ways of doing the things that our society sort of normally kind of puts within this box of sexuality.
You know, it's when you're saying this, I mean, this is really fascinating to me, too, because I start thinking about the workplace, too. And there is, in the modern workplace, kind of this idea that really you cannot touch one another. You know, that, mm-hmm. I mean, we go to workshops. We get, you know, I'm a supervisor. I had to go to this extensive workshop. And, I mean, one of the sort of the fundamental message is here, you better not touch one another, because all touching is at least open to the interpretation that it's sexual in nature. And so there seems something eminently healthy, David Jay, about what you're talking about right now, this notion that people could actually touch one another and it wouldn't be sexual.
Yeah. Well, this is, I think, related to this idea that you need sex to be happy, and sex is the only place where all these things happen, is this kind of collapsing of big, big, diverse things like touch into sexuality. Mm-hmm. So exactly like you were saying, all touch gets interpreted as possibly sexual. And that's in part because we just don't have good words to talk about touch that aren't about sexuality in some way. We don't spend as much time thinking about all the kinds of affectionate non-sexual touch that sort of we all want and that exist in our lives. We spend way, way more time talking about sexual touch than we do talking about those. And I think if we take the time to really sort of define them and understand how they're different, then that can be a good, healthy thing for everyone to do, not just the asexual community.
Yeah, Kathy Wei, I want to swing this back to you. It seems to me one of the things that is true, though, is that conversationally and in terms of our consumption of popular media, we live in a sexually saturated society. People are almost unable to talk about – you can't talk about tennis without talking about who it is you'd want to do, whether it's Navratilova or Sharapova or, you know, or Federer, or, you know, you can't talk about anything without that. And I mean, for a lot of your life, first of all, feeling as you do and not feeling as you don't, you must have been often sort of silently standing on a circle outside everybody else as people sexualize virtually every possible conversational topic. True.
Yeah. It is true.
How'd you deal with that? Did you sometimes pretend you were sexually interested in or able to sort of join in a conversation like that?
Well, most of my life I was shy, so that took care of that. But once I got out of the shyness, I do tend to go away from that stuff or stand on the sidelines.
You know, David Jay, just to sort of come back to that idea, too, of the workplace, it is, when I came to work here in public radio and I would be sort of theoretically supervising people, I did have to go through this training process and, you know, some things were talked about. But I can guarantee you that no human resources department in America, well, I can't guarantee you that, very few human resources departments in America are factoring asexual people into any conversation, any thinking that they're doing about workplace sensibilities. And I would assume that might be one of your goals, too, to get a little traction there.
Yeah, yeah. And, I mean, this is sort of unrelated to the earlier discussion we were having about touch, which is, I think, a very, very complicated issue. Right? I'm not saying that we should step back on the excellent safeguards we have in place to prevent sexual harassment. But there's a recent study that came out by two people named McInnes and Hodgson, not from Brock University, which talked about, is the first study to really look into discrimination against asexual people in the workplace. And what they found related to some of the things we were talking about earlier about the way that sex is seen as essential, they found that people, when they hear the word asexual, imagine someone who is mechanistic and inhuman. Mm-hmm. They imagine someone who kind of doesn't have a full kind of human social experience. And they and because of that, they will indicators show that there's a high chance that they'll be discriminatory in the workplace. And the likelihood that asexual people, the study found the likelihood that asexual people will be discriminated against in the workplace is within the sort of framework of, within the kind of range of the likelihood that LGBT people will be discriminated against in the workplace. And so as a community, this is something that we're beginning to take really seriously. And we are beginning to look at how to partner with different organizations to do workplace education to begin to address this issue.
I mean, the issue of being taken seriously, I think, it is part of it. There is, you know, I'm as you're talking, I'm thinking a couple of things. One of them is, and we've done shows about this too, that, you know, and this is there's an imprecise analogy, which I'm about to make. But, you know, it gets said a lot that we'll have a Jewish president and maybe even a Muslim president before we'll have an atheist president. And that one of the things that you really can't do in America in public life is self-identify as an atheist if you're a high-ranking public official. People just get freaked out by that in a way that they don't get freaked out by any actual religious belief system. And in a way, seeing this topic get played out, seeing some of the other interviews that you've done that are available online, it's almost as if, and this will be the last question before we go to a break here, but it's almost as if people are not prepared to take this subject seriously.
I think that for many people, and Kathy, I think this connects to some of the experiences you were talking about, many people have a really hard time getting their heads around sort of the idea of a person that doesn't have sex as a part of them. I think sex is become such an important part of many people's worldview that when I stand up as asexual, it's almost like I shouldn't be able to exist. It's almost like I've broken some law of physics by being a person who's standing here, who's living a happy, fulfilling life that doesn't have sexuality as a part of that. And that, I've found, forces people to stop and rethink things. Like just me standing up as an asexual, people doing the education work that I do, forces people to stop and rethink sexuality in a way that I think is really interesting.
All right, we're going to grab a quick break here. We're going to add Tony Bogart to this conversation. We have with us Kathy Way and David Jay. There's no particular reason why their names should rhyme, just because they're part of the same topic. We'll be back after this. All right, we're back. We're talking about asexuality. If you have a comment or a question, our number, 860-275-7266, 860-275-7266. Asexuality, we're kind of understanding as a kind of sexual orientation in which people just find their sexual drive or their sexual desires to be so negligible as to constitute no real factor in their lives. We'd love to hear from you about this, if that's you, or if you just can't quite wrap your mind around it. Either way, 860-275-7266. You may tweet us at WNPR Colin. With us right now is David Jay. He's an American asexual activist. happens to be a Wesleyan University grad and the founder of Asexual Visibility and Education Network, AVIT. Kathy Way is here with us. She's a Connecticut resident, and she's the person who first kind of turned our attention to this whole topic. We're also going to add Tony Bogart right now. He's a professor of community health sciences and psychology at Brock University, which I believe is in Canada. He's the author of Understanding Asexuality. First of all, welcome to the show. I know you've been listening to a good bit of it so far. And maybe the place to begin, I want to sort of circle back to this whole question of kind of understanding this as an orientation as opposed to a disorder. As you know, the world of psychiatry has gone through this multi-year wrenching process. I don't know how much it spills across the border in organizing what's called the DSM-5, the latest edition of the psychiatric classification manual. And whenever that happens, there are, you know, obviously with every single category, there are stakeholders, and there are some people who want something to be identified as a disorder so it's eligible for treatment and insurance reimbursement and stuff like that here in the United States. And then other people who don't want it defined as a disorder because they want it to be understood as sort of part of the normal spectrum of human behavior. So give us a sense of where asexuality, how asexuality is clinically understood these days.
Yeah, it's a very good question. It's certainly the case that the DSM has been in a sort of state of turmoil about a number of different sort of diagnoses. One of the interesting and important ones is related to, human sexuality. It used to be the case that the DSM would probably categorize asexual people as having a disorder and probably would have diagnosed them under category of hypoactive sexual desire disorder. But recently, partly because of David Jay's thoughts and activism, and also probably some of my writing, and also because of Lori Brodo, there's been a change. And now the DSM at least has some level of flexibility with regard to not diagnosing people who self-identify as asexual. I think that could be done even further. But I think there has been a movement towards not seeing asexuality per se as a disorder. And I think that's ultimately a good thing, and I certainly address that in my book to some degree, along with some other issues.
Yeah, and I guess they sort of, I mean, first of all, the DSM-5, my understanding is it sort of did a little bit of reclassification, created this umbrella of sexual interest / arousal disorders. But that's neither here nor there from the point of view of what you're talking about. The real question is, does it need to be called a disorder at all? And you know, as you do research on this, I mean, is there pushback? Are there clinicians who say, no, I mean, no, it's a mistake to normalize it. It's a mistake to suppose that it's simply one of several possible normal sexual orientations.
I think, you know, again, things have changed to some degree. It used to be the case that I think, you know, in Kathy's case, for example, clinicians would automatically assume that there was some sort of problem that needed fixing. But again, you know, in the last 5 years or so, there's probably been a shift. And that shift has probably come about because of some of the activism that David and his group has created, along with some of the writings in the academic literature, including my own and Lori Brodo's at UBC. And it's oftentimes now seen in a sort of more cautious way, and people are less inclined to, in fact, stigmatize it as necessarily a disorder. And partly that occurs because you can start to see that sexual variation, sexual minorities, are not necessarily problematic if, for example, they don't have distress about their lives. And it's certainly the case that in David Jay's case and other asexual people's case, they don't necessarily have to feel distressed or actually feel a disconnect to other people simply because they lack sexual attraction or lack of sexual interest in other people.
Yeah, Tony Bogart, I'm going to ask you and David Jay both the same question. But, I mean, this is sort of a horrible question, but I'm going to ask it anyway. I mean, does anybody try to come up with an estimate as to, you know, what percentage of the population in any way fits this category, asexual? I saw 1%. I saw 1.5%. I don't know how relevant a question this is. As I say, questions about numbers always strike me as pretty
well,
awful.
I reviewed that particular kind of issue in my book, and I also sort of started the conversation, I guess, in 2004 when I published a paper using a national sample in Britain. And about 1% of the sample indicated that they had never felt sexual attraction to anyone at all. There's been other more recent kinds of well-conducted studies, and they varied in terms of the type of question that they ask, along with the percentages that they give. And I think still about a reasonable ballpark figure, at least in my mind after reviewing some of that work, is that 1% is probably not a bad figure, a sort of working figure to kind of work with.
And David, how do you feel about that? I mean, I don't know how, as I say, how relevant the actual number is, but people get curious about stuff. How many of anything is there that people always want to know that?
So I think that I take the 1% number that came from your excellent work, Dr. Bogart, and it's great to talk to you again. I take that as kind of a rough estimate. I think that for me, because my role is really to serve at the center of this community, I'm very hesitant to call anyone asexual unless they have taken that word and chosen to use it themselves. I mean, we really believe in the asexual community. Relating a little bit to this issue of pathology, you know, if someone shows up, a 16-year-old kid shows up in our online community and says, "Hey, I really, really relate to what you're talking about. I think we might be asexual." What we say to them is, "Great. The word asexual is a tool and not a label. If it's useful for you to figure yourself out, if thinking of yourself as asexual for some period of time is going to help you understand yourself better and help you work through whatever you need to work through in your life, then that is fantastic. And if you keep using that word for the next 80 years, then that's really, really amazing. And if after 3 years you realize the word is no longer useful for you, then that's amazing too." And so we really are hesitant to go around kind of putting that word onto people who haven't chosen to use it themselves.
You know, while we're on that topic, Kathy, since you're here, this sort of tracks back to one of your original communications with us. I mean, there's also that question. It sounds like for you it was incredibly useful and incredibly encouraging to understand that there was this word, there was this term, there was this community, although not necessarily the case that you wanted to go march in parades or hang out with the asexual community. True, false? Help me out on that.
That's probably true. What it did was just release a lot of anxiety around how I felt, and that just felt really good. I don't know much about the marching with the community, but
just in terms of like even getting, I mean, I know that you know now that there is asexuality.org, a website to go to anyway, but it's not like you're on it all the time checking out the latest developments.
No, I go to too many I get online and I go all over the place.
All right. So, by the way, if people have questions about this, 860-275-7266. 860-275-7266. You know, Tony Bogart, we talked earlier about this, about the whole idea of including this notion of asexuality and, you know, even the kinds of education that goes on in the workplace about, you know, how to just handle diversity, how to handle sexual orientation as a form of diversity. But in a way, this goes back further. I mean, you know, in schools all across North America, there are human sexuality classes, and there are efforts made, once again, to create environments of tolerance for people who are gay or lesbian or bisexual or transgendered. But this, the A word, just doesn't really, I'm sure, come up in those contexts. First of all, is there any change in that? I mean, is there anywhere where this is, where instead of LGBT, maybe it's LGBTA?
You know, I think that's changing as well, and I think it's a testament to David's activism and thoughtfulness about communicating issues associated with asexuality. I think part of the reason is that asexual people have been invisible and kind of under the radar, and in part because their lack of sexuality is not something that is oftentimes observable. You know, in contrast, a gay person, if they engage in same-sex behavior, even sort of same-sex romantic behavior, holding hands with someone, people can recognize them as different. So the absence of sex has not been very visible. But I think now that there is more of an activism, there is more of a sort of self-identification, and also there's been more of a kind of movement to pathologize a lack of sexuality in the last 20 years or so, there's been a bit of a backlash so that people are now interested in stepping forward. And I think there is an element or an important point that needs to be made with regard to educating people about the spectrum of sexuality, the spectrum of sexuality in terms of some people are just not interested in sex, not interested in sexual activity with other people. And then there are people in the middle, and then there are people who are more hypersexual in some regard. And so I think there is a place for increased education at both ends of the spectrum, along with just general information about sexuality, period.
All right. Let me grab a call here from Mike in Bristol. We got a lot of calls coming in at 860-275-7266. Hi, Mike. You're on the air.
Hello there. My question is about gender portrayal, and I'm curious if asexual people, if they're born male, tend to portray themselves throughout their lives as males and female as females, or if there's more fluidity in that because, you know, there is no attraction to one sex or another.
Okay, well, so that you're asking sort of about the relationship between gender identity and sexual orientation, particularly sort of asexual orientation. David Jay, I'll let you start. I mean, you probably talk to more asexuals or correspond with more asexuals than anybody else. How does that play out?
So this is an excellent, excellent question issue that one of the other things I think is really excited about our community. So I'll start by saying that the majority of asexual people are cisgendered, meaning that the gender that we were assigned at birth when the doctor looked at our bodies is the gender that we still use. However, there is a definitely statistically disproportionate number of people who identify as transgender in some way, including many people who identify as gender neutral, as experiencing as neither male nor female, and as gender queer. And it's led to some really, really exciting discussions about gender in the asexual community, the way that gender and sexuality interact with one another. And I won't recount all of those for you right now, except to say that one of the important conclusions of that discussion is that it's best to try not to guess at causal factors, at guessing at – it's good not to try to guess – why someone being asexual would make them more likely to be transgender, genderqueer, or vice versa, because it's a very, very different relationship for everybody and a really fascinating one, but not one that I think you can draw easy conclusions about.
Let me grab a call also from Bill, and I have a couple more questions for Kathy. We've got one more whole segment and one more whole guest to introduce you to, so we have to move relatively rapidly. But here's Bill from Pocketuck. Hi, Bill.
Hi, how are you doing?
Just fine.
Good. I just wanted to bring up something just wanted to say I can really have compassion for the people that don't have this, they have an asexual feeling. They shouldn't feel alone because there are a lot of people rendered that way through medical procedures, let's say, kind of really spelling it out, but let's say prostate cancer, where you are basically have a choice. The choice is life, and then you may have to become asexual. It eventually makes you that way due to the medical procedure that'll be on, let's say, a male, then they find that they are understanding what it is to actually feel not anything for anybody, just simply a world of, I don't know how I could put it gently, basically not feeling anything because hormones are completely suppressed, and that can actually make you understand other people a whole lot better. So there are people out there who are actually who understand what you're going through, yet they don't fit any type put into a category like you are putting people into, I guess.
Yeah, you know, this is a great point that you're making, Bill, and one that had not really crossed my mind. And I don't know who's best equipped to answer this, but maybe Tony Bogart, just for a second. You know, he's talking. This is sort of different. It isn't. I mean, I think most asexuals, most members of asexuality.org, Asexual Visibility and Education Network, are going to be people who are people like Kathy, who for their lives, you know, have self-identified this way, feel like they were kind of born this way. But there's a whole bunch of other people who, yeah, because of, you know, whatever prostate surgery or whatever, wind up kind of in that category. Although I assume as a scholar looking at this, you look at that a little bit differently.
We do, but there are similarities, and you know, I think one of the interesting elements to discussion about asexuality is that it opens up a kind of new lens or allows us to see sexuality from a new sort of perspective, and people can have that perspective from different for different reasons, and it can be something that may be induced because of hormonal issues, medical issues. But even people who are sexual can sometimes be afforded a new view of sex simply by sort of taking a little bit of a distant view of sex. And one of the reasons why I wrote my book was to actually deconstruct sex to some degree and see it from a doomed perspective and kind of learn about it in a different way and see the world in a bit of a different way. And so I think it is related, but it is a separate phenomenon than, for example, David or Kathy's kind of asexuality, which is something that they have had for their entire lives.
I want to ask Kathy and David the same question before we go to break here. And that is, and David, maybe I'll start with you, but I want to hear from Kathy about this too. Gay people inevitably talk about coming out, about the moment at which they came out or didn't come out or the decision to come out. Does it work that way for asexuals? Is there some burden to either come out or not come out?
Yeah, there definitely is. We talk about coming out all the time, and we talk about sort of, like gay people, an experience of realizing that this is the way that you are and then exploring that and then needing to share that with other people. I think one of the differences is that if I come out as an asexual people, most of the people I'm coming out to don't know what that word means. Mm-hmm. And so I have to spend a lot more time explaining it. And that's, you know, good in some ways because they don't have preconceived notions, but also can be challenging because I have to do a lot of education work.
How about you, Kathy? Was it something that you felt the need to come out about to the people around you?
I didn't do any coming out until you called about the show. Then I decided.
We were the cause of this then.
Yeah. Then, well, maybe not. Then I first person I told was my nephew. He's gay. Mm-hmm. And I sent him a message on Facebook. And then I just posted on Facebook mm-hmm. to everyone that was the way I was. And I got about 3 responses.
Mm-hmm. Supportive, I hope.
Yeah.
All right, good.
Yes.
All right. We're going to take a little break. We're going to come back. We've got one more guest to introduce you to and a lot of calls to take and a lot of ground to cover.
Today's show was produced by Patrick Scahill, Betsy Kaplan, and me, Kyone Wolf. The part of Bill Curry was played by Dennis Rodman. On tomorrow's show, the story of breasts in athletics. And now, back to Colin.
Yeah, on tomorrow's show, breasts were invented a really long time ago. The sports bra was invented in 1977. And athletes, women athletes, and actually, as it turns out, male athletes sometimes even, have to sort of struggle with kind of how to fit them in to your athletic performance. Anyway, be a very interesting conversation. We've got 3 journalists who've really looked at this. We're talking right now about asexuality, about people whose sexual orientation is that they do not experience strong waves of sexual desire. 860-275-7266 is the number if you have questions, if you want to talk to us. 860-275-7266. You know, we're going to add to the conversation Julie Decker. She blogs as Swank Ivy, and she is an asexuality awareness author and educator. Julie Decker, you've, I think, listened to the bulk of this conversation. You know, I've touched a couple of times on the whole question of discrimination, and we certainly understand and know about discrimination against people who are LGBT. Is there I guess for people to discriminate against asexuals, they would have to know that asexuals exist, and that's perhaps you know, a part of the equation that hasn't been solved yet. But is there discrimination directed at asexuals?
I would say yes. Some of it is just because we're erased. We're not seen in a public conversation. We're assumed to be straight most of the time.
Mm-hmm.
If you're non-practicing, the assumption is that you're a straight person, then you're just not very good at it. But I think that most of the time when people are asking questions about discrimination, they want to know, is there like a quantifiable, observable, institutionally handed down kind of discrimination? And you're right, it does require that we would identify as asexual, that we would have come out in some way. Although sometimes if you just behave as is consistent with your asexual identity, you'll be assumed strange and weird. And as the study we were talking about earlier, published last year, found that people assume that we are mechanistic and robotic and all that stuff. And just those things, even if we don't identify as asexual publicly, can cause us to be discriminated against.
You know,
there are a host of ways that can manifest in your life.
You know, it seems to me that the prejudices that you're talking about, that sort of notion of mechanistic, is one of the prejudices, but I think there are other ones. And one of them, I think, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, is, and I think it's sort of used in a humorous but ultimately disparaging way, is sort of that you're boring, that it's a boring thing. Actually, let's play. This is a little clip from the movie Love and Death. This is Woody Allen talking.
You know, some men are heterosexual, and some men are bisexual, and some men don't think about sex at all. You know, they become lawyers.
And I think that's Woody Allen's way of saying, if you don't think about sex at all, you're probably boring. And so, Julie Decker, I'm assuming, and this might be something David may want to talk about too, that's something you have to overcome too. That it's not that I'm asexual because I don't have enough pizzazz to think of some sexual ideas.
Oh, absolutely. It's the punchline. We're a punchline. We're nothing. So, besides just being left out or being the punchline of a joke, there are definitely other ways that kind of tie in with this perception that we're not full people if we don't connect with other people through romantic and or sexual relationships. I mean, there has been a case of an adoption denial to a man and woman couple that were married. And they go to get adoption papers filled out, and they say, well, you're a man and a woman. Are you infertile? Why are you not having your own children? They say, well, we're asexual. We'd rather adopt. And the response is, well, if you're asexual, you're not fit to be married.
You know, David Jay, as we're talking about all this, I mean, one option always was and perhaps always has been not to talk about it. You know, and I think when I told people about the show and I talked about the fact that there's an organization and that there's a flag, a very nice looking flag, too, a purple, black and gray and white flag, I think. And there's a symbol, a black ring symbol. I think people are very surprised to hear all this. And I think a lot of people would sort of think, well, you know, I mean, it would just be easier to kind of stay underground and not tell an adoption caseworker or a coworker or anybody else that you're asexual. What's the argument against that? Why, you know, why be open? Why have visibility?
So I think that there's sort of the big reason for me, which has to do with one of the answers that Kathy gave a little while ago. There are so many people in the world who feel isolated. who feel like they're alone, who feel like they're the only one who's having this experience. And I know what that, like, I used to feel that way. And I think the biggest reason that I'm visible is to be able to reach out through shows like this and let people know they're not alone. But I also think just at a practical level, living in a society where everyone assumes that everyone else is sexual, it takes work to be closeted as an asexual person. Contrary to, you know, the assumptions you were saying before, most asexual people get hit on. Most asexual people have people pursuing us sexually. And it is much, much easier for us to be able to explain to those people what's really going on. And, it, you know, in my case, often if someone's pursuing me sexually, I still want to have a non-sexual relationship with that person. I don't want them to feel rejected. I want them to understand that, like, I'm interested in them. I'm interested in getting to know them and spending time with them, just not in being sexual with them. And being honest about who I am and about my orientation is a really good way to do that. So I think that the life becomes easier when I can be honest with the people around me about who I am and what I feel, rather than having them assume things about me that aren't true.
It's a great answer. Julie Decker, first of all, I just want to remind people that the informal name for asexuals is ace. And so obviously when gay people were not as above ground as they are today, there were gay bars where they could go and hang out. And David is talking about getting hit on. Are there, to the best of your knowledge, Julie, ace bars where you can go and not get hit on?
Definitely not. We do not have a physical presence in the world yet, although we do have some meetups and there are asexual dating sites.
All right. So and we have a call here from Emily that might be germane to this. Hi, Emily from Torrington. You're on the air.
Hi. I was just wanting to say there's an online community called FetLife, which is probably the largest alternative sexuality website, and it's pretty international. They do give you the option of identifying as asexual.
And what's the name of the site again?
FetLife, FetLife.
So that's a place to go and kind of mingle with everybody, right?
Yeah, it's all alternative. BDSM, gay, fetish, kinky. But, you know, they have a lot of gender options. They also have a lot of sexual options.
That's great. Thanks for telling us about that. Julie, one of the many – everything I knew about asexuality was wrong. I just didn't know anything about it, really. So one of the things that I thought as we were getting ready for this show is, well, in terms of sort of entering public consciousness, being more visible – you know, one of the things that would help would be if anybody famous ever identified as asexual. And then I immediately assumed that nobody ever had. There was nobody I'd ever heard of who identified as asexual. Julia, apparently I'm wrong about that, right?
You are.
You want to mention a few people?
Well, I think that sometimes there are people who have said that they're asexual and then they took it back because they didn't mean it in that way. But I have heard, for instance, Janine Garofalo said that she was an atheist and an asexual on stage in one of her comedy routines. She's the first one that comes to mind.
Yeah. So, I've seen a bunch of other names, but I don't want to violate their privacy. I mean, maybe, David J., you can talk a little bit about that. Is that important to have people that other people know and recognize, either fictional characters or real-life celebrities who self-identify this way?
Yeah, I think it is. And so Morrissey is the first name that comes to mind for me. And I would say that we're at this point right now where public understanding of asexuality is really just reaching its peak. And there's sort of beginning to be this public consciousness of what asexuality means. And we're getting to the point where we're really going to start seeing asexual characters in TV shows and asexual characters in movies. And we're going to start seeing famous people coming out as asexual. And for better or worse, that is going to determine the stereotypes that most of the world has when they think of asexual people. So as a movement, we're at this really critical point where the work that authors like Ivy or Julia are doing is really, really important, where being able to tell good stories about asexual people is ultimately going to sort of affect what the world thinks of us.
All right. Listen, this has been a fascinating conversation. We want to thank David Jay from AVEN, that's Asexual Visibility and Education Network, Kathy Way, Tony Bogart, Julie Deckert, who blogs as Swank Ivy. We'll be back tomorrow with a different show, but thanks to everyone who listened to this one.